Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Ralph Gerke is speaking on buried cities and collected scrolls. So let's listen in on Ralph.
An introductory illustrated lecture on the archaeology in the Bible. Just what it says, archaeology, the methods of how to dig up a buried ancient city without destroying the evidence that that city can provide. And the second thing I'd like to do today is to take up the Bible, as people don't usually use it. They usually see it collected in 66 books in one book. But it's actually a library of many books. Most of you know this, which were collected over many years. It was a growing collection. Yes? All right. I'm sorry, they don't have any good hearing device. So maybe if next time when you come in, if you can sit closer, I'll try to project. But that's good that you let me know. Thank you. The Bible is a collection of various books. It's a growing book, and we don't usually understand growing books. So what I'd like to show you is the light that these archaeological discoveries, especially the Dead Sea Scrolls, put on our view of the Bible. So that'll be kind of today's lesson. So I think before I start with the slides and a few other handouts, by the way, I gave the last handout to the last people. So if you can kind of share this when we need it, you don't need it right now. I'll be very happy. I didn't know. I brought these from Tacoma, and I said, well, last time I had about 15. Maybe if I have 18, I'll have enough. As you can see, you're more than 18. But we'll work that out. Archaeology has become one of the foremost ways in which we modern people can get evidence right from the time when things happened. If in archaeological discovery in Jerusalem, they can actually find the millo, kind of the stepped, we'll see pictures of that later, 3 days from now, platform on which David built his, city hall, the center of his city hall, that's a very important thing, see that? And so it actually comes from the time of David. And if you go to Jerusalem, you can see it. It's been uncovered, although it had been covered for a long time. And so it is a very important thing. Today, people read in the newspaper, and too bad, I have to warn you against that. There's too much of what I call tabloid, scholarship going on. People make it controversial and then make money off of it. Otherwise, newspapers and journals don't sell. But I try to do not hard-nosed. I'll try to be popular here, but I will take a neutral position, and it'll become very clear to you, why do people argue about the date of this layer or that layer? Or why do they argue about that? And sometimes we don't know. And sometimes we do know. So I think what I'd like to do, I'm not the type of teacher, I'm retired now 5 years, that just told students, now this is what authority says, so-and-so says, this is what authority so-and-so says, this is what authority so-and-so says, and I think it's this way. But I'd rather put you in the kitchen and not give you a cookbook and teach you how to cook and how to find the own ingredients and kind of put it together for yourselves. And that way you kind of understand it. Well, how is this done? Well, the first thing is that if you have a project, and I was involved in one, it has to be sponsored. You have to have a sugar daddy to provide the money. It costs a lot of money, especially today. In my case, the Aid Association for Lutherans made an agreement with a number of my friends. I wasn't on the top leadership, but I was in on it, to have an expedition an archaeological expedition in Palestine at Taanach. It was a biblical city mentioned in the Bible. And they would get not only the experts who would lead on the staff, but anybody who wanted to teach in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Old Testament would be invited to have hands-on archaeology, so they kind of knew a little more of what they were talking about. And so they put up about $40,000 for the project. After two sessions of it, the six-day war came, and the price went up the last time. They thought that they have $10,000 for the first session, dig, and then $10,000 for the next one, $10,000 for the third one. They had planned it very well. They have $10,000 for publishing, but the costs are enormous. And it has been completed, those three sessions, and the publication, I have one of them right here, has been done, which doesn't always happen. There are a few things need to be done, but most of it doesn't. So after you've got the sugar daddy to supply the money, you have to get your staff. That includes, as you'll see on the slides, surveyors. And they wouldn't have taken me on the team if I hadn't had, I studied classical archaeology at the University of Chicago. They want people who know what they're doing. This is not a learning experience. You would have to kind of be somewhat expert. The people who did the actual work were about 300 Palestinian people around about. And they came in the morning. It was really quite colorful. And we had, it was extremely well organized. But now let me get down to how you do this. First, you have to have a survey. And I'll show you some pictures of the survey so you get some idea. And that has to be expertly done, because everything has to be scientifically established, so that if you find a something like this, and this was found there, you have to know where the find spot was, in what layer, and at what spot, so that you can reconstruct it. Because once you dig in it, you're destroying your evidence. I hope you'll all understand that that's what we like to do. And we have a lot of preparations like that. We've got to have a strategy. We spent our whole first week in Jerusalem planning a strategy. And the whole last week, one of the hardest weeks I ever had in my life, trying to put it all together, because it's like a jigsaw puzzle and a lot of the pieces are missing. One of the hardest jobs I ever had. The chosen mound, after it's been surveyed, and you start work, you have to realize that these buried cities, not quite like Mother's layer cake, they aren't quite that nice, and but the main rule that a lot of people don't know of archaeology is that human habitation can only be on the level. You can't work and live on the slant. So if there's human habitation, it's on a level. And then, since these structures would never be as large as this, King Solomon's throne room would never be this large. He had some cedars from Lebanon to hold up the roof and so forth, but that was very small. Compared, most of the rooms are very small, and mud brick. And what happens to mud brick? It deteriorates, and then they have to smooth it over and start again. You see that. So it grows up. You see that over the period. Sometimes it just degenerates. Sometimes the Assyrians come in and burn off the roof, and then you have to start over again. So it crumbles. And to merely do what people did first when archaeology was in its infancy, to try to find treasures. You know, dig through and find it. That would destroy everything, wouldn't it? So the method is to do what? To peel off these various layers. You see that? So the most recent ones are at the top, and you have to go down. See that? And you have to be very careful. You see some stones there. And you say to the Eric workman, "Dear fellow, be careful, you guys. don't move those stones, because they like to take those stones out. They might be part of a wall. You want to have that as evidence. You see that? But you come at it not at the bottom of the wall, but you come at it from the top, like a bird from a bird's eye. And that's kind of interesting. So the idea, and I'll repeat that, is that you should be able to peel off the layers, and the archaeologist can record the find spot of anything that you find there, like that little jug up there, or anything else. I kept a notebook, and I have a copy of the very notebook that was in my back pocket. And every, we call them a basket or a wicker basket, and then a rubber basket. If there was pottery, you put it into the wicker, because then it had to be washed, and it was very important. The workers didn't always think that was so important. And I have to tell them that pottery was more important than gold. So they didn't quite understand that, you see that. Although some of them, the main workers that did the roof with the pickaxe and so forth, and I tell them, Asherin centimeter, 10 centimeters, that's all you can do. And so some of them were experienced. And so, but then the regular dirt you have to put out, because there's an awful lot of accumulation of mud that has nothing in it, you see. And you have to be very, very careful. And for that reason, what you do is you divide this whole mound into squares, usually 15 feet by 15 feet. But you leave a bulk, a 3-foot bulk, between the squares. And then you can control your evidence. Not only can you control it on the side, because as you go down, I went down 27 feet until I finally got bedrock. You can read on the side of it, as you'll see very nicely in the picture, better than my description, you'll see the various layers. And my Arab workman would say, now, when were the Yehudi, the Jews, here first? And I'd say, from that layer to that layer. And they'd say, well, yeah, it was all Arab before, and it'll be all Arab after. That's the way life is when you live right in the midst of it. It's kind of interesting. What you have to look for is, in these layers, as you go down, is the alphabet of archaeology, and that's potsherds. That means broken pieces of pottery. Now, if it's just a side sherd, it isn't that important. But let's take, for instance, this one, and I'll pass these around and you can touch them. It says on the Teltonach, and it usually gives the Middle Bronze Age or whatever it is, and it's faded, or like, this is a jug, it's a rim base. So this was a jug, and that's an important part of pottery. And then it was a rather large jug, you see that? And if we've seen enough of them, we can, from just one little part like that, it was a significant part, reconstruct the whole thing. Or, let's say, a few others here. What do you think that is? Well, it's a handle. And here's going to be another one. And there's going to be a large for storage. You see that? Either dry or wet, depending upon what you have. This is from a bowl.
What?
A bowl. Some bowls were used for putting bread in and dough and baking, and some bowls were on the fire for cooking and all liquid. And this is a rim from it, you see that? But you can kind of present how large that bowl was, and you can kind of tell. Just like an experienced antique dealer today, even if he does archaeology today in some fine little colonial days, you'll know what it comes from, isn't it? And you yourself will know the difference between gay 90s stuff and streamlined pottery. You don't have to be an expert. In fact, the Arab boys and schoolboys who work with these people, they will know that. Here's a jar. Notice it has a rim. And he splash rims. Sometimes I buy stuff and they don't have any splash stuff. Well, some of them have burnishing. They are on a fast potter wheel. They dip them into a nice solution and they look really nice. Notice how thin that is. It's not quite eggshell, but it is very thin. And so it is very nice. Well, I'll just put some of these in, and I'll pass these around. I think I'll start at the end. And would you please be very prudent, not just in not dropping them, but in handing them to somebody else so you don't just go past. Keep them maybe in one line, and then whoever's at the end of the line or someone else, see to it it gets around. Is that all right? I think we can do that rather than I'll give a lot of directions. Be careful to hold it at the bottom and just kind of touch it. It's holding stuff you'll see for a while. And then several other things. This piece, by the way, comes from Qumran. It was given to me by one of my students. Another student dropped it, so don't drop it again. But it's actually one of those that was there when Perdue, they first did it. This I bought in Jerusalem. What do you think that is used for? You're right. Or maybe oil for anointing kings, you know? I'm teasing. That comes from the time, Iron Age 1, the time of David. So that, I bought that. And just to show you what cuneiform is, this is a facsimile, it's not an original. Those of you in museums, here's a little cuneiform tablet. So writing is important, especially when we come out of Bible writing. And the last thing, I'll pass that way around in the back here, is don't drop it. It's the only pay I got for all my volunteer work that time. And that was, we found a mold for this figurine. And this was made from the mold in the British Museum in Plaster of Paris. And it's put for on my wall. You can see at the bottom, it was given to Ralph Gerke as an appreciation of the work. We also got a very nice Arab dinner from the crew. Great big lamb and all kinds of stuff, yes. We really had a lot of fun. Now, I wonder whether there might be people who can turn those, I think you know how those things to darken that? Or maybe I can. You know how to turn that machine on there too, where it says power? Okay. So it just sounds like it.
Hi.
Yeah, I think so. And then let me try that and see what I can do for sure. Okay, good. Thank you very much. And let's see, I think we better get the lights off here that hill. And now we'll see some of the things I talked about. Is that pretty clear to everyone?
Yes.
There. Okay. Now, that's a typical buried city. That's not just a hill. Anyone looking at that in Palestine, the farmers would simply say, that's a buried city. Most of them haven't been excavated, by the way. Isn't that interesting? There's a lot of evidence that hasn't been found. And so whether anybody has the money to do it, I don't know. You see, they're rather regular. Here's another one. By the way, you can see on this particular one that the Israeli archaeologists have made a trial trench alongside here. Instead of going all the way through, it cost a fortune to take off every layer, wouldn't it? You can only choose strategically one section, and then you can take up the things and gradually get. This comes from Timnath. That's where Samson got one of his girlfriends before they cut off his hair. This is Tel Tanakh. That's the place where I was. And this is, I think that's a little better, isn't it? I'm sure I don't have this. This would be a rather large city. In the early Bronze Age, they made large cities. That's about almost 30 acres. And they put, you can see it's a mound. Part of it had been a natural mound, but they increased it. And they put fortifications around it, which would hold all of that accumulation of debris inside of the wall, wouldn't it? Go up and down. And in 1903 and 4, people from Austria and Germany had come and dug there, dug a lot. And now we came with their permission to start this three-season dig. We lived down here in the orchard. This was the village, the local mosque. And we said, we're only going to work here. I was on this team, working to try to see how the fortifications were. We're looking at the city gate and saw we never found it. The Germans had found this big one over here. We never found anything. Well, we wanted to find something next to the sanctuary where they worship, and then a domestic section, and the palace. This palace had 34 little tablets that were sent down to the Pharaoh of Egypt. by the king who lived in it. So we're reading, writing, see that? The Germans had found that. And until recently, this was the had the most place to give a writing of ancient times. The king of Tarnach wrote to the Pharaoh of Egypt. It's like finding state departments. I told you that they have 15 by 15 squares. Our director said, we want to have them a little longer, so they have 15 by 15. Oh, look down here. This is called the fortification area. And this was my square. And you have a dialogue north-south, and then you have another one east-west. And then you have everything so that any one of those pieces, when Eugene said south, tell Tama, southeast quarter, and then you give the number. So that's kind of the way in which you, let's look at part of that. I told you that you do the digging as you go down in little squares, isn't it? And you keep a bulk in between. And then here they have taken the bulk out, and now you can see how the wall extends, you see that? So from that particular layer, you can see, got a pretty good idea of what is happening. They don't leave this in until, well, it's up to the situation, whether the director wants to take down the bulk or not. If you look closely, you might see me up here. We were on a military, zone between Jordan, at that time, National Kingdom of Jordan, King Hussein, and Israel. And we could only go in with military help. We couldn't excavate anything in the northern part because that was a military section. And we had to get off the mountain, never could go later in the afternoon, and we had to be very careful. When we staked out our measurements and for our work, the Israeli jets came down to see what we were doing. It was a military operation, you see. And the air workers would shake their fists at them. So this is kind of the hill we climbed every morning to get up there. By the way, here you can see what has happened. They staked out this square, and they oblong, and they found these tremendous big rocks that people had used as part of the fortification. It had rolled down. Somehow the foundations were very good. And it had covered the little steps down here, a pottery storehouse. And can you imagine, a sophomore in college, it was the one who found the jackpot of all the best pottery. So if you go down to the museum, the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, you'll find some of our Tanakh found by a sophomore in college. He was just kind of lucky. They were looking around for tombs, and that's what they found. Now, this is Walter Rast from Belgrade University, who was a good friend and working here. He's standing there next to that wall that I and another friend of mine were digging out. This is a wall that is as old as the pyramids. This is an early Bronze Age. So this is pre-Christian Palestine, Canaanite Palestine. And you can see here that that wall, it curved here. There was some sort of, this has never been explained, there's some sort of a projection, some sort of a projection. This is bedrock. And you can see that in the early days, whoever went there used to have fires in these little holes. There was that evidence. But you often find things like this. It seems, we thought at first that this was part of the fortification to protect the gate, but that didn't work out. Our theory was wrong. So we really don't know what the structure was. But you have to make a record of even those things that you don't understand. And here's one of the men from King Hussein's Amman headquarters, and he came to visit me standing actually at my square, with one foot, his right foot, on that wall, just pulled around, and the other one, I had put himself here, the inner wall, on top of a fortification, as you can see, it was built on top of that wall. We didn't know whether that was a fort to protect the wall. That was a theory, but that never worked. Here, by the way, is the bulk. We kept that 3-foot bulk and the little steps down there so that the workmen could do that. And finally, I went down, as I said, 27 feet down there, and that was quite low. I went down to bedrock. And this is a bird's eye view. This is the type of bird's eye view that the architect would finally have to make. Here is that wall I talked about. Here is that unexplained scene that some sort of this has to do with the fortification. Some sort of structure, real complex sort of structures. And this may be a kind of a fort that was built on top of everything. So I was working in Southeast 126. That was my square. And I was kind of lucky because a lot of it was my was that wall and these other fortifications. And I had a big there. So I think of the 8 weeks that we were out there, I must have been done by about the 6 weeks. I had everything done. Mm-hmm. I worked with other people. That was kind of nice. Now, here's a much better picture than those that I've showed you so far of one of those walls. And you have to put these little tags here. You can say that this one is red bricky, or this is clay. And here you can see someone has dug in at some time, kind of a pit. This would be a habitation floor here. And here you can see a wall has come through there. It's a very complicated sort of thing. As a jigsaw puzzle, but gradually you get to know not everything, but you get to know a lot of things about it. And a technical man, this guy comes from Texas, will come along, and if you can see, he does this all very accurately with a measuring line. He smooths the wall very straight, so that if you go down and you see it on the four sides, you can kind of see what the various layers were like. And then here, a level. Here, a lot of this particular mound had eroded down the side. But with putting all the things together, they can pretty well reconstruct even what had, in this case, been eroded. And you have all these surveying people that we had one from Texas A&M that was on our team. And he was very, very good. And we could see what was going on. Here's a number of little juglets that were found maybe in a pottery factory. As I said, the pottery that is important is put in a wicker basket and then taken out and washed. Now, they have to be very careful because maybe there's writing on it. Now they don't try to put all these pots together, and they don't need to, as I showed you, because if they have enough information on it, they can then write on the important parts the name of where it's found, Tel Tana, southeast quadrant 126, and then it will be kept in, until it's published, it will be kept in Jerusalem at the American School of Oriental Research. Only a few times do they really put all these things together. You usually don't find all the pieces, but this is museum work. But usually you make a record. Actually, this is a bit outdated. Now, most of the records are done on computers in such a way that when the dig is done, you don't have nearly the work to do that we had to do in 1966, when I was there. Here is an Egyptian making the mud brick. This is sun-dried brick. This is not kiln-dried brick. That's why it still disintegrates after a certain length of time. But in a few spots, as for instance here, you can see it's been preserved quite a bit, isn't it? It's been about 6 or 8 feet high. And then you have the foundation below. Here shows how they got good clay. And we try to find out where it was and analyze it chemically. And I think most of you people know enough about pottery wheels, hand pottery wheels, or with your foot, and how they put ornaments on it and how they fire it. So that's not much different. But we find those various things there too. And this is a reconstruction that the American Institute of Archaeology commissioned an artist Sulu to do. And it was published in a wonderful series in the National Geographic called The Last 1,000 Years. It was really a nice series. And you can see them doing the same thing. The boy is helping him out here, maybe his father, and apprentice actually moving his feet, moving them with his hands, and turning out the clay. The pottery is so important because it is the, what do we call it, the alphabet of archaeology. Now, I have prepared for you, and I won't give it to people who are interested in it, but if you'd like to have the exercise in armchair archaeology, I will be very happy to have anyone, there are 18 copies here, and you can kind of do some art, explain what the exercise is, and bring it back for tomorrow. Those are lamps from various periods. Archaeologically, this would be the lowest one. This is early Bronze Age. Notice it has four wicks. Well, that gives quite a bit of light, doesn't it? In a place. Remember in the temple, they had, what, seven branch candlesticks, seven lamps? And then there were seven of them, so that was 49. That was the highest candle power in the country. And that was, they put enough oil in there. This is a simple one at home, just with one wick, but the olive oil is very expensive. And so this would be the time of David, this would be the time of Joshua, this would be the time of Abram, and this would be even before Abram. This would be the time of the great prophets, Isaiah, of the great kingdom. We call it Iron Age 2. And this would be the Persian period. There you can see it's very elaborate. And here, finally, they said, well, why don't we put the wick out here and put this here. So that's the Greeks did that, the Hellenistic. Romans did this, and that's the Byzantine Christian one. So when you find a lamp like that, you can almost find it. When they found a lamp like this in the Dead Sea Scroll caves, they said, Roman times, somebody's been able to see that. Didn't prove everything, but it would tell that for sure. And the same thing, here's my little jumpet, isn't it? And I put some exercises there to tease you. Now, I'm not interested in making people be teased who don't want to, so, but I think there are enough, and if somebody doesn't have enough, you leave your name with me and I'll try to get some copies made up in the office here if I can, if anybody wants to. So the exercise is to how did they use these things? And so, how about, instead of doing this all right now, why don't you do this for me while I get down to the slides and ask the people to raise their hands, and then this gentleman will give it to anybody that wants to take it. How's that? Does that make sense? And why don't you just walk right straight through, and everybody that wants it can have it, and then we'll have a little exercise at the beginning of the next session. Archaeology. But usually, you know, I'm still a teacher at heart. I find out that if you ask people to work at something, they kind of learn it, and you ask questions, and it becomes very. Don't be diffident. I'm quite sure that not everyone is interested in doing something like that, but there are two sections in there, and it hooks up together with the first handout that I gave. All the people who came in first, there aren't enough of those either, but if anybody wants some more, leave your names at the end of the session, and I'll be very glad to get something in the office. So, some of you guys are kind of ambitious, are you? In other words, pottery is extremely important, and once you've identified your layer, with the potsherds, and then all of a sudden a piece of writing comes up, you know when that writing is somewhere there. And that's why, thank you. And listen, why don't you put those that are left right here, and if anybody still wants one, they can pick them up. How's that? I think that might be a good way to do it. Okay, thank you. Now, the next part, I'd like to speak about the Bible. But before I get into Bible manuscripts and that, we have to talk about writing. That's why this is wedge-shaped writing made with a little stylus. And this was before it was put in the fire. It was on clay, impressional clay, and they would make a little writing like that. Well, I don't know whether you can see what I'm doing here, but if I put this a wedge shape like this, and a wedge shape like this, and a wedge across here, I've got it upside down, but it would be a B. Isn't that an opposite component? Didn't you know that R, E, M, and alphabet, the first letter in the alphabet, is an ox turned upside down? And the word alpha in Arabic and Hebrew and all those languages does mean ox. And that they used a kind of picture of it. So this is the earliest, well, maybe hieroglyphics of Egypt are just as early. I don't know. This is very early. This was found, however, in Palestine at Megiddo, and is part of a famous epic, almost like Homer's Iliad, called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And so this is rather important that they found that at Megiddo. This is called the Gezer calendar because it has on it a little rhyme that was made. This is a schoolboy who's learning, and he writes pretty well, who's writing, well, I used to have to learn, I think most of you, 30 days has September, April, June, and November. And this is what it says. They had two seasons. They had a wet season and a dry season. And they start always at the time of year where we are right now with olive harvest. His 2 months are olive harvest. His 2 months are planting grain. His 2 months are late planting. His month is hoeing up of flax. His month is harvest of barley. His month is harvest and feasting. His 2 months are vine tending. His month is summer fruit. So we know pretty well how they wrote at the time of David. That's rather interesting. And notice it's a little different from the Hebrew that you usually see in Jewish synagogue or in Israel writing today. Here's another one. This is from Moab and across the Jordan River, not far from modern capital city of King Hussein, Hamas. It was destroyed by some of the local people, but the man who found it, he happened to be a German Lutheran missionary, was sensible enough to make a copy of it because he knew when he gave it back to those people that they might do something with it. Then they finally got these pieces. See, the Arabs thought that there was gold in there. And by burning it, they could get that gold out and so forth. And so this didn't work. But listen to what it's actually said. I'll read you part of it here. I am Misha, the son of Chemosh, that's his god, the king of Moab. My father had reigned over Moab for 30 years, and I reigned after my father. I made this high place for the god Chemosh. So this was set up as a statue in a temple. See that? Yeah. Because he saved me from all the kings and caused me to triumph over all my adversaries. As for Omri, this is a very important king mentioned in the Bible in many places, king of Israel, he humbled Moab many years, for Chemosh was angry with his man. And his son followed him. And he also said, I will humble Moab. In my time he spoke thus, but I have triumphed over him and over his house, while Israel has perished forever. Not quite true. But you can see how this is a very important find, isn't it? Now this in this case was there. And once you get writing, of course, then you're really in business. This was found in modern Iraq. At that time, it was the Assyrian capital. And Sennacherib, the famous man, buried this in a temple foundation stone. Why? In order to preserve a record for the future, especially for the gods whose temple this is put in, about his deeds. But in one section, I'll just repeat it by memory instead of reading from the book. As for Hezekiah, the king of Judah, I shut him up like a bird in a cage. Precisely what the Bible says, that he came at the time of Isaiah and besieged Jerusalem. And then he describes all the booty that King Hezekiah had given him. Get rid of it. And the Bible describes that too. Almost in the same words. It's very interesting. And then at the end, he doesn't say that he took the city. He doesn't tell the story about that the Bible tells about how the prophet Isaiah gave the oracle of salvation. He'll not shoot into this city, for I will protect it for the sake of David. That means the one from whom Messiah would come, the son of David. And that was, of course, a statement of belief. I mean, we wouldn't expect Sennacherib to tell about that. But that's cuneiform. Notice how beautifully it's done, isn't it? The people who worked on there were experts of the whole country to make that beautiful thing. Now, this is a notepad that was found at the time when another conqueror, this time from Babylon, his name was, well, most of you know, Nebuchadnezzar, and he came in order to conquer Jerusalem. And in Lachish, one of the hill countries, in the guardhouse and in the tower next to the gate, these notes had been sent. See, that's a broken piece of pottery called a potsherd, and had written. And I think I can give you part of this letter. Yes. It's kind of long. My servant Hoshaya, that must be the man who's in charge of some outpost, who's writing it now to the main general in the main town, has sent to inform my lord Joash, may Yahweh cause my lord to hear tidings of peace. I'm well, I hope you are too. May the Lord bless you. That's the way you go. And now thou hast sent a letter, but my lord did not enlighten my servant concerning the letter which thou didst send to thy servant yesterday evening, even though the heart of thy servant had been sick ever since thou didst write to thy servant. As for what my lord says, dost thou not understand? Call a scribe. As the Lord liveth, no one ever undertook to call a scribe for me. I can read and write. I'm not dumb. That's what this soldier says when he writes to his general. As for a scribe who might have come to me, truly, I did not call him, nor would I have given anything at all. Then he comes and talks about something else. He has to report. It hath been reported to thy servant, saying, the commander of the host, Coniah, has come in order to go into Egypt. We don't know why they're going down to Egypt. Are they leaving Jerusalem? Well, we don't know, but he talks about it. As for the letter of Tobiah, the servant of the king, that means one of the officials in Jerusalem at the court, he has come to Shalom, son of Judah, through the prophet. Which prophet is it? We think it's Jeremiah. Saying, beware, thy servant has sent it on to my lord. I'm sending you a copy of that letter. Isn't that interesting? That was found by the Harvard Museum, Reisner, many years ago.
That whole tablet was that letter, or was
it? There are a whole bunch of letters, and if you go to the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem, they're all up there on display, and in a book like this, an archaeological book, they'll have them all. Even if you looked around in the library here, I think you'll find some information on texts, encyclopedia Britannica, or something like that. Now these are signet rings, and they have names. Look at this one, even has a fatty cock. It's a servant who worked in the palace, and he is there, calls himself. And this is beautiful. Notice now we have block Hebrew, like you're used to seeing, aren't you? To this place were brought the bones of Uzziah, Melech Yudah, the king of Judah. We know King Uzziah. Don't anybody open it. So they have been buried. This was found in Jerusalem. And what language is this? Come on, you people. Yes.
It's Greek.
Greek, yes. And this was found from the second temple as it was restored by great King Herod. And it was the one that stood there on a pillar at the court of the Gentiles. No Gentile can go farther than this spot. The women could go outside that. You remember that? The women couldn't go so far as into the court of the men. Remember that? The Israelite citizen. And only the priests could go where?
And
the high priest could only go once a year into the
Holy Lords.
Remember that? That's the way it was. And this is actually from Jerusalem. And it's not in the Museum of Istanbul because the Turks had it when they so long moved around and used to take those things around. Now, the reason why I mentioned that is that right here is important. To understand much of the Bible, you have to understand that at first certain things happen, events. Let's say I'm reading and studying Jeremiah now. There's a big Nebuchadnezzar's coming, and there was a big crisis. So the word of the Lord came to the prophet Jeremiah. It says, chapter 36, take all of the oracles that you have orally spoken and collect them. So what happened to, he first spoke it orally, then it was repeated, and then it was written, and then it was compiled. Even in the New Testament, ladies and gentlemen, when St. Luke tells us how he made his gospel, he said in first four verses, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have happened, been among us, been accomplished among us, he says, just as they were handed out from eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, and there were a lot of writings, there were more gospels than Luke. Luke even had Mark to depend upon. So it seemed good to me, O Theophilus, Luke continues, having studied these things for some time, to write an orderly account of the things that have been accomplished. You see, if things weren't written, would we know much about these things? So writing is very important. But isn't the first step? No, there was a lot of history before it. See that? And in that case, you can read it in chapter 36 of Jeremiah. The king burned that first scroll. And so then Jeremiah didn't write the next one. He dictated it to his secretary, Pharaoh. And he said, take a scroll and write. And so at the dictation of Jeremiah, Pharaoh wrote all these words. So don't think that the ancient world and the Bible came together the way modern books come together. Now, we'll show you some slides on that, and I think that might be helpful. Can you turn that on again?
Okay.
All right.
It's been nice for a while.
All right. Yes, that's very good. In the Middle Ages, people used to think that a holy person like an evangelist, they didn't know that they had scrolls. But really, I was mechanically reproducing what had been revealed in heaven by the heavenly messenger. And that was kind of mechanical inspiration. See that? And I believe, certainly, in the inspiration of the Holy Scriptures by the Holy Spirit. But I believe that all the evangelists were really living persons, living as Ralph Gerke is, and were thinking and working all the time, even though the Holy Spirit inspired them. So inspiration, yes. Dictation, no. If you had an ancient book, this is from a German book, and it's kind of a joke book about that. The title in German is, this is a book for people who think they can understand the book, the Bible, but don't really. Here this man says, man konnte endlich Kapitel 59. If you had a scroll, you had to find chapter 59 of the book of Isaiah, you'd have to what? Roll it. Even in the synagogue, they have a way of keeping it together and then putting clamps on it and putting it back in the treasure and then bringing it off the next Sabbath, you see that, and knowing it. But that's very uncomplicated. But you know what people did? And it was early Christians who first did it. They said, why don't we cut this in sheets and then put a binder back here and we can write on both sides, you see that? That's how we got our modern books, they call it a codex, you see that? But in the early days, well, this is kind of the way things were written. By the way, the Jewish synagogue, don't they still write by hand the first five books of Moses? And some of perhaps have seen that so far. Now, this is an ancient picture coming from the Jewish synagogue made by Jews of an ancient book, the Ezra reading. Very interesting. And this is how the Bible first came to be. This is from a synagogue, and it's kind of a little, what should we call it, a cabinet. And you can see the scrolls here on edge. You can't hear, this would be Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. The first Torah, see that? And this would be the four prophets, and then this might be Isaiah, and then Jeremiah,
and Ezekiel, the big ones, then they had all the minor prophets on one scroll, and they have Isaiah, well, we don't know this well, they have it. This is a synagogue, you see that? And they had, that's the way they write it. So the Bible was a collection then, and it grew as time went on. And the Bible is not meant for papers of religious sections in newspapers today. We're making a lot of money at controversial things that are not always well reported. Nor was it made for university classrooms, even though I'm a university professor. The Bible is made for what? Synagogues and churches, you see that? For people. And that's what it was for. And then people, of course, now with printing, everybody has it. But the word canon originally meant those books that can be read openly in the assembly, I'll say a synagogue or a church. And when it came to New Testament times, this is a reconstruction of a wonderful book by the National Geographic Society, Life in Ancient Times, of the way a library in North Africa was, where people take out books and notice they had a scroll here. So St. Luke not only wrote the Gospel of Luke, but he also wrote the Acts of the Apostles, and then he wrote two of them. And in this case, this artist pictured a scribe, an official scribe, that will write a letter. Perhaps this man is illiterate, you see that? He had come to the library steps, and this man may be a friend of his. But that is the way in which they had many books at first. Here comes from that German joke book. Excuse me for doing this. I hope I don't offend anyone here. And I hope the cartoons are those characters that sometimes offend people. Here comes some archaeologists, and they are really going home with their land over, and they say, the guard at the down in the desert says, where are you guys going? He said, we're going to try the original text of the Bible. We really want to find the original text. The next part is that after a long time, they had it, the memory has it at two. And the guard says, and what about that original text? Did you find it? And they said, nope, still missing. What happened after? They weren't trying the 66 books, not even the 39 books all collected. We do have 39 books, the oldest rabbinical manuscript from Aleppo in the late Middle Ages. So we have very old, but not nearly going all the way back as old as that was. The oldest complete Bible that we have comes from this monastery of Mount Sinai, which I was privileged to visit last February. There was a church here built by the Christian Emperor Justinian, and he built the walls around, and thought the buildings are reconstructed. and of course, monastery, they have their library, and there is the oldest Codex Sinaiticus. If you've been at the British Museum, they have it on display there. But it comes from Mount Sinai. And that's the oldest Bible that we have. In other words, our Bible has been copied. Whatever happened, and here's I made a chart, and I'll slide it. Events happened, they recorded or they wrote it down. First they wrote without pause and punctuation. That's why they could get so much on a page. As much as we have. They copied and copied. We have no traces of those ancient Hebrew manuscripts. They made translations in Greek already at this time because the Greeks in Alexandria couldn't understand the Hebrew anymore, so they had translation. They made Aramaic targums or paraphrases because a lot of people couldn't understand it, even in Syria and Palestine. And then they copied it in Syriac, in Shido, they copied and copied. And the oldest, here they put in vowels, then they sent you maybe a Latin translation, they put it in the oldest complete Hebrew Bible that we have of 39 books would be here at this time. So when they found those famous Dead Sea Scrolls, I'm going to show you some pictures of that now, they were what? 1,000 years older, see that? Did you ever hear the story of how that happened? A boy was out there, a shepherd, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he threw a stone up into the, and it clinked, and he thought it was a genie. His cousin was as scared as he was. His cousin climbed up there and found the first cave under one, and They took it back. They happened to be Christians. The Syrian Orthodox Christians. They took it back to the bishop. And he knew it was important because he was a trained, learned person. He took it to the American School of Learning and Research, and the man, Mr. Trever from California, was on duty. He was an expert on manuscripts. Can you imagine that? He almost had a heart attack when he realized that this was a really ancient thing. He asked whether he could keep it overnight, and he happened to be a very good photographer, and he made photographs of that all night. It's really excellent photographs. And the man picked it up later, and later it was sold on the market in New Jersey. That's a long story. But do you get the idea that we have to really be honest about this? You see that? But archaeology is filling this in. You see that? We don't know many things, but you will find something prettier. But you know, this is how. I'll show you that in a minute. Skins of animals and it deteriorates. The only reason why this was so well preserved, these caves here, this is the Wadi Qumran, is bone dry, and therefore it's well preserved. And so that had to be paid for. See, those, it's called Jewish monks that put them there. The Romans were coming here, the war was going to break out, so what did they have to do? Bury their precious documents. They had more besides the biblical books. They even made these jars for that purpose, especially made. And then they were killed and never came back until 1948. This is a reconstruction again from the National Geographic, but rather nice how they perhaps copy. One man would read it, and the other people would do, and the mass production, isn't it? Did they make mistakes? Well, yes, if you want to call it mistakes. But this is Holy Scripture to them. They're not going to fool around with it. In fact, they wash their hands before they begin to touch the Scripture, and after they've touched the Holy Scripture, they wash it again before they go outside. And that's the background. See, we have about 3 or 4 minutes. Let me just finish this. If you have the section of the... I'm sorry, I'm looking for something else that's not here. I forgot to put a slide in. This comes from Isaiah chapter 40. A voice says, cry. And I said, why should I cry, for God's sake? It's going to be a terrible job. The flower of the field, the flowers do what? The grass withers, isn't it? There's no use of being a prophet. Everything is a nonsense. And the answer of the Lord's messenger to the prophet is what? Yes, the grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God dies forever. Now, what is in the original manuscript, and this is a photocopy, when I did this in Chicago, the congregation I used to be, one of my former students said, I'll help you out with this, I'll make this all and put it in English so the people understand what you're saying, because it's a bit complicated. The original thing is all in underlining in red. But somebody added here a note. And here, instead of putting the name of God, they didn't want to speak the holy name of God because they might go against the second commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. And so they only put what? 3 dots or 4 dots. And then he wrote, look at that guy, he wrote here, down here, and messed up the manuscript, that nice old manuscript. You see that? Now, if you take it to the original, I have that in regular letters, a voice says, cry, but I say, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades. Now here, what's been added above? When the breath of, but he doesn't even put that word Yahweh in, and that's why my student, former student, seemed to put this in brackets, you see that? That's a gloss, it's an addition. It explains it. When the breath of Yahweh blows upon it, surely the people is grass, and the grass withers, and the flower fades. But the word of our God, he even put that down on the site, will remain forever. So his note is complete.
But the others had gone down here, when you hit the two lines here, but the word of our God
will remain forever.
And ladies and gentlemen, that word remain is Yahoo. You remember when Jesus healed the little daughter of Jairus and said, Talitha Kumi? Damsel, arise. The word Yahoo means rise up. The word of God will do what? Rise up for each occasion in the future. So you can be a prophet that I will give you my word and it will.